All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the February crew call with Mike Rose. This is volume 2-2, meaning second year, second month. And we're going to stick with that because why not, right? And we have a new crew member tonight that we're going to be talking with. It's Thomas Gazier, who I'm going to call Tom from here on. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing well, Mike. Thank you.
I wanted to have Tom on the show because I like to have people on who look like they're doing interesting things in model railroading. And Tom, I'm going to give you a brief overview and then you can correct everything I screw up here. But Tom, I think, started out as a DLW sound install customer. And he's a Union Pacific engineer. And I'm going to ask him some more questions about that. And he has his own blog on Model Railroad Hobbyist and his own proto-freelance model railroad called, I believe, the Split Rock Mining Company. And he is doing a lot of interesting modeling. So we're going to talk to each other about our layouts because I think we both have a lot of questions. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
How much of that did I get wrong? Anything?
No, I think you're right on.
Okay.
Right on.
And you know, I think we did start out with you doing, with me doing some sound installs for you. And that was got to be 2 or 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, I think more than that. I don't think the soundtracks two were out or anything.
That's
like
right.
That.
Those were early soundtracks installs. And of course, these days I mainly do log sound, though I'm a, you know, a soundtracks dealer and still would do soundtracks installs. But it seems like most of the momentum seems to be still with log sound these days. Have you ever tried one?
I have on other people's layouts. You know, I think the technology, it's kind of like the VHS or the CD or something. When's it going to end? So
that's right. It's a different animal.
I don't want to switch all over. And then the latest thing comes out. And then I think you did that. So I did that.
Maybe you saw that picture I posted of like 100 engines at Mahoopany that I had redone, pulling out soundtracks decoders and putting in log sound. And I think to remember the caption was something like, this is what all in looks like. And I'll tell you what, I have no intention of doing that again. I don't care. That was about the third time around for some of those engines because, you know, some of them were DC engines that had NCE DASRs that I put in originally, and then I put tsunamis in them, and then I put log sound decoders in them. I'm kind of done putting decoders in the same engine now. You know what I mean? I'm satisfied with where I am.
Yeah, and then, you know, they update the speakers, and it's not getting any less expensive, so...
Well, no, that's true.
I'll leave my soundtracks ones in the future I'll go to soundtracks two or log sound.
Yep. And you know, I've tried a lot of different speakers, and in the beginning I was using Railmaster speakers, which were pretty good speakers, but boy did they take up a lot of room inside. And I like to have a power pack or keep alive on all of my engines. So by going with the iPhone 4 speaker, and in some cases other smartphone speakers, like in switchers, I tend to use the HTC, which also has a good sound and is a little bit shorter and a little bit thinner. So I have a few more options when I'm doing an end cab switcher or even like an RS3, you know, which has very little hood room underneath.
What's an HTC, if I can ask?
It's HTC.
Oh,
and
HTC.
That's just another brand of cell phone. And so each one has its own speakers, you know, that they typically use. I've tried iPhone 5 speakers as well, but I tend to prefer the iPhone 4 speaker. And some manufacturers are using those too. Rapido uses iPhone 4 speakers as well.
That's what I have to put in my new ones. And they're very cost effective too.
They're inexpensive and they're reliable and they're weirdly shaped, which in a way kind of works sometimes because that little sort of space in between the barbells and the ends, that's where I tend to tuck together the resistors for lighting usually. You know, it gives me a little extra spot that I can utilize.
Have you ever cut them and put a baffle in? I've seen people try that too.
I have done that. In some cases, I've shortened it up a little bit and re-put the baffle in. you do get a little bit loss of bass because it's a very, very carefully tuned enclosure. But sometimes if you're not shortening it too much, you don't really notice the difference. And like I say, in an end cap switcher, which is always the, you know, the most challenging install to do, every little bit of space you save helps a lot. But again, that's where the HTC has come in, because it being a shorter speaker, it's about the same size as a shortened I4 speaker. And as such, you don't have to compromise the enclosure to use it.
Nice. You don't do any M-scale installs, do you, or narrow gauge?
I did one once, and then I thought, this is a little bit too much like heart surgery on mice. You know, it's especially in N-scale locos, if they're not the more modern type that actually has a place for the decoder. Perfect example, the Kato NW2 switcher. It's built like an N-scale locomotive with the two halves of the weights kind of bolting together with insulating washers, and then the motor and drive line is sort of inside this sort of two-piece casting. It's just a bear to work on because you have to completely disassemble it in order to do any milling, to remove any material, in order to have a place for the speakers. And then there's no way to test it without a full reassembly. And if you have any issues, now you got to take it all apart again. And it's really a bear to work on. I would say that's probably the hardest HO switcher I've ever worked on for that reason. And I need one for my Pocono Northeast short line. So there's one that I'm working on, but I actually ended up, I had two of them I was going to use, and I ended up trading it to a buddy of mine. And in return for the P2K Jeep that I'm using also for the Pocono Northeast, he had the right phase. So it kind of worked out. I just couldn't bear to do that one more time.
Do you think your milling machine is very beneficial? Because that's why I came to you, because you said I can put decoders in these little Alcos of mine, because I can mill them down and then keep the weight. And that's why I went with you, because no one else was willing to do that, and you had the skills to do that.
I don't think I could call myself a pro sound installer if I didn't have a milling machine. And I literally use it on probably 90% of the installs that I do. A high percentage of people coming to me have maybe purchased current, I don't know, Atlas or Bowser locomotives or Rapido, you know, with Loke sound decoders already in them. And they have older Atlas locomotives or other brands that they want to install the sound in, or it might have sound in it that's not up to snuff, or it's not fully compatible with their Loke sounds and they like the way their Loke sounds run. So I do a great deal of retrofit, you know, and the older Atlas locomotives had these big blocky weights inside. Proto 2000 was the same deal. You know, you open up the locomotive and it's one solid hunk of metal. I don't know how you do an install in either one of those without having a milling machine. You can certainly hack it up with a hacksaw if you've got all day, but it's not a very efficient way to do it. So a trick Brian Banna showed me was to take a sawzall with a certain kind of blade. It's got to be a very widely spaced tooth blade, because the metal in these weights is very soft, and as you're cutting, you can clog up the teeth on a regular metal cutting blade very quickly. So I use this special blade in a sawzall, and I remove most of the material, and then the rest of the weight goes into the milling machine vise, gets lined up, and then I use the milling machine to take off the last of the material and give me a very fine machined kind of a finish to it. You know, you wouldn't want to have it look like you hacked it with your teeth and then, you know, sold that off as a professional install. So the milling machine gives you a lot of control as to the finish of the weight that you end up with.
It gives you a good surface there. Yeah, if anybody knows tools, it's Brian Banna for engine. So.
Oh, yeah. No, Brian is an old friend, and I've known Brian a long time. He's been to my place. We've run some of his terrific looking locomotives on my layout, and I took some pictures and video. You know, it's I haven't seen him in a while because we're not geographically close, but you know, just I think it's a small pond, you know, that we're all in, and you either know somebody else or you know somebody who knows somebody else. It's not 6 degrees of separation. It's more like two.
Yes. And Brian did one of the things that really amazed me that he fessed up to, and you did too. But what Brian, when I watched him building his engines, he said, I'm not a model railroader. I like building these as models and stuff. And I think it took him a while before making a layout or his copper country. But for somebody to do this and then tell the rest of us, I'm not a model railroader, we kind of look on in awe, like, wait a minute.
Yeah, there are certain modelers that I think of as model builders, you know, and
right.
And when you build a layout, as you know, it soaks up a lot of spare CPU cycles there. You know, it's you can't be as anal as you might like to be about every single detail when you're building a gigantic model railroad, you know, and right. I mean, maybe a really small layout, you know, you could do that with, but there's just so much to do on a layout. I always laugh when some people come over and they look at the whole layout, and I always joke that there's two kinds of people. There are people who just kind of go, wow, and ask you all kinds of questions about it and seem to be very interested in the whole process of it. And then there's the opposite person who says, geez, when's this going to be done? You know, and there's not much in between, really, you know, and the when's this going to be done crowd can't understand that it'll never be done. And that's kind of the point, you know, with a model railroad, you can refine it indefinitely. I don't think you'd ever run out of things to do on a sufficiently sized model railroad. You know, that's just how I feel about it. So, now you're building a model railroad, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your background, because you're one of those pro model railroaders, right? I mean, you do it in real life as well. You've been on the railroad your whole career, basically?
No, basically about the last 20 years.
Okay. And you started, did you start with UP or was it not UP?
Yes, yep, I started with UP. They just absorbed the CNW about 5 years before.
Okay.
And that's why I work on the CNW Rock Island, Great Western, the old Evan Sandell lines in the Twin Cities. So
nice. And were you a rail fan before that?
Oh yes, yes. I had a family. Family was railroaders.
Oh boy.
And you know, I did the whole, went to college and then did the military thing. I was in the Marine Corps for a while and then came out and had the corporate job, and I didn't like that. And I remembered everybody worked for the railroad, so they were hiring, you know, back then in the early 2000s.
Sure, they weren't contracting.
They weren't contracting, so they needed. So I got in at the right time.
And you must have an amazing collection of photos from back in the day.
Yes, yeah, kind of. When I look back at them, I'm like, oh, this is interesting.
Yeah, you could give a heck of a slideshow, I'll bet. And how, a buddy of mine today asked me to ask you, how's that precision railroading thing going for you?
For me or for the company? I don't know.
well, both. And I don't know how much you can talk about that as an employee. You know, I mean, we certainly hear the stories.
It's an interesting concept. It I don't know who it really benefits, us or the customers or the shareholders or something.
The stockholders, absolutely.
The stockholders, absolutely. Well, the best way I can describe it to everybody is they switch from running trains to running cars. They don't want a car to sit in a yard more than a day.
Okay. So dwell time.
Dwell time is it. That's the whole thing. Keep that car moving, and unless somebody wants it, you know. So it's almost like a model railroad. You know, every car in Hoopany is going to be gone at the end of the session. You know?
Are they moving cars even when they don't need to move?
No. And that's kind of where they run into the problem. Like, I work a job right now that services industry. So I'm like the end guy.
Are you on a local?
You could call it a local. I'm not on, I'm on what I call an industry job.
Okay.
I service four different industries, and then we work the rip track.
Okay.
So one of our customers, they're a chemical company. So we actually bring them the cars, the chemicals, and we haul away the empty tank cars.
Okay.
And where they run into the problem with this precision rail is they'll order in 10 cars and they'll be in the yard, but the customer can only hold four.
Sure, which is pretty typical, actually.
Which is typical. And so then they get, you know, they're looking at us and they're looking at the managers like, well, this tank car, you know, TILX 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 has been here for 3 days. And they're like, well, they haven't emptied one, so what are we going to do with it?
Well, and this is something that's kind of always been that way, right?
Correct.
So how do they expect, so is this a factor of people who don't know railroading are trying to make these decisions?
I don't know. It's been handed down from the CN and the Canadian Pacific and right. out of ours and some other.
Good old Hunter.
Yeah, good old Hunter. I'll leave it at that. This is a family podcast. So
Right. Strong opinions, right? Strong,
yeah. So it is almost model railroad like with a, you know, you have a way bill and it's gonna go.
Yep.
Versus, so they try not to have holes and things, and that's why they're finding out which cars are moving a lot, and that's why a lot of them are in storage.
Now, do they charge the customer when they have to hang on to cars like that?
I think they do. I think there's a demurrage charge.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times they'll order in more than they can handle. One of the industries I serve is a fertilizer place.
Right.
We actually have to go out of town, go on the main line to go get there. And they right now have over 30 cars at their facility.
Wow, it's a big facility.
Big facility. And they could have probably another 20, but they unload like 3 a week.
Okay.
So they've got them on their property, so they're not paying us.
They're not paying the railroad, but they might be paying the leasing company.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a warehouse on wheels.
So what, I mean, what's a typical train size for you?
Varies any day from like 10 in, 10 out, you know. And what's odd about my job, I try and tell people, is I work on a switchback. And the year's 2020, and to get to our industries, we have to leave the yard on a tail track.
Interesting.
On a set of crossovers. Then you flip them back, and then you go down this industry along the Mississippi River. But it's a switchback. Hmm. So
you have to, you're probably planning your moves in the order of business before you even leave the yard.
We have to. There's no runaround.
Do you ever have cars on each side of the engine?
No. They can only be on one end because we have to escape.
Okay.
But all the industries, the main three I serve, they all have a track mobile. You know what that is? A little gizmo.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll actually leave them out on the industrial lead there, the branch line. We don't spot them at the customer.
Oh, I see.
But we put them in an area where they can come out and get them.
So you don't really switch out to the end spot any of your customers?
No.
Interesting. And what are you using for power these days for a local like that?
Anything from SD40-2s to Jeep 60s to Jeep 38s.
Yep. And two-man crew?
Two-man crew.
Are you usually hopping out to throw a switch?
I will.
Yep.
You know, I was a switchman, and the guy I work with is a really good guy, so if he's back 20 cards.
Exactly.
I'll get it.
You know, I had a chance to ride on the Reading and Northern on a section that I model. It was actually the Mahoopany job. They stopped and switched out ransom paper, and then they went up to Mahoopany, and I was able to get a cab ride while they did all of this. And it was a two-man crew, and it was the same kind of deal. You know, the conductor did 90% of the work on the ground, but occasionally engineer just hopped out of the engine and threw a switch, and it just made everything work better, you know?
Yes.
It was very interesting to watch him do that, because I realized that they had all the same issues we do on the model railroad.
Exactly.
That told me we were doing something right there, I think. So did you start out as an engineer, or did you start out as a conductor?
You start out as a conductor switchman. I was a switchman in the yard.
Okay.
So I had about a year and a half of that, and then they were pushing through engineers, and I took the bid as soon as I could.
Yep. Have you also done over the road work?
Right. That's where I first went. That's what they want. And it was kind of funny. It was about the same time I got married to my lovely wife. And that's when I got marked up as an engineer, promoted. And they sent me, this time they were doing, they have these, you've heard of long haul trains, you know, everything used to go. Well, now they were doing long hauls. So I was sent to a little town in the middle of Wisconsin that was halfway between here and Chicago. Hmm. And that's where I had to work out of.
How far was that from your house?
250 miles from my house. for 2 years.
I would have moved.
Yeah. I almost did. Because they put you up in a hotel there.
Sure.
And then
being on duty 24 hours a day. You can't do anything else.
But it was odd because, they put you up there because you're forced there.
Right.
So they paid for lodging. So I was in a hotel there. And then you get on a train and I'd go to Eau Claire, Wisconsin or to the Twin Cities.
Yep.
And since that was my away terminal, they put you in a hotel there. So for 1 year, I spent 333 days in a hotel.
Wow.
and that's
great for a newlywed, of course.
Well, yeah. But it was, my wife's at home and she was working at a salon at the time, a manicurist. And of course, all the ladies ask, where am I? And so finally, she never could explain roading. So she finally said, I said, tell them I'm a trucker. They'll understand this.
Sure.
But we used to laugh and joke about, I'd get the hotel and during, she'd come visit me. We called them conjugal visits. And so her clients were like, is your husband in prison? No, we're just joking. That's our joke.
And that went on for 2 years.
Yeah, until I could bid seniority, enough guys were retiring then that I could move back to the Twin Cities and hold a road job or the extra board there.
Very interesting. And how many more years do you have before retirement?
A lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. Cause I figure as long as I'm healthy, they don't force you out the door.
Oh, okay. There's no mandatory retirement age.
I don't think till you're in like the late 70s or something, even 80s. Cause we had guys that were in there, still healthy, that engineers.
Well, obviously you're still kind of enjoying it because I know other railroaders, if you ask them when retirement is, they could tell you how many days, weeks, months, hours until the retirement point, Right. So I guess it really depends. So you're probably in a lower pressure section of the railroad, I'll bet.
Yeah, that. And then plus with our hobby, I do enjoy it. I do find things to enjoy and I work with really, really great people.
And I have to ask, what's life like above the Arctic Circle like that?
It's brisk. It's tough. Our biggest issue, everybody can dress for weather. You can dress for going to Antarctica, but during the day when the sun comes out and the snow kind of melts, it flows to the low points, which is where the switch points are.
Okay. And then freezes.
Freezes in the afternoon. So, my switch man will spend an hour chiseling out a switch.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's terrible, because they've cut the track gang so down. But that's what we always gripe about. I said, just get the switches to throw.
Right. And I guess switch heaters would only be on mainline stuff, right?
Correct. Yep.
Wow. I never even thought about the ice aspect of it.
Yeah. That's the one that gets us. You can push snow out of the way.
And your winter ends about July 1st and starts up again about September 1st.
Yeah, August 3rd, somewhere in there.
It must be so beautiful out there at times, though.
It is. We have our moments, but like where I work along the Mississippi, we have floods. It's just.
Oh, right.
But it's real pretty up here. It's like New York. Upstate New York. I think everybody gives New York a bad rap because of the New York City, But you get outside that, pictures you've shown, everything, it's pretty rolling countryside.
Oh, it might as well be Pennsylvania. I mean, it's really the same kind of terrain. Interesting. So tell me a little bit about your model railroad. How long have you been working on it? And, how did you even come up with that concept?
Well, I'll stick with the current one. When we got married, we had this house with her father, and since we had more kids, her and I decided to add on. So we made our little addition, our bedroom. We made a mudroom, new garage. And so they gave up this little tuck under garage. I don't know if you've seen houses with the garage.
Underneath. Yeah.
So they walled that off and we made that part of the basement. I said, well, that's my layout room.
Sure.
And they said, don't you want the rest of it? And this is one of I call it one of my smart decisions is I was on the road as an engineer. So I didn't have set days off. I didn't have set times. So I had to build a layout for me.
Sure.
And so I didn't want to build this big thing because I couldn't, every other Wednesday I'm going to have five guys over. I would never be home.
I see. And again, it may not always be like that in your entire life, but for the foreseeable future, that's what it looked like.
Right. At that time. And I said, so I really cut it down and I had the the guy's doing the dish, and I said, well, can you align it with 2x4s and just this portion? And then I said, I wanted to really focus. I've always thought, you know, people who model like you and Mike Confalone and Lance Bynum, if you focus on something, it eliminates so many other things.
It's true.
You know, do less, but with intention.
In my case, I found that I went the opposite direction of some people. I started out as proto freelance, and which is wide open, depending upon how faithful you want to be to the proto part of it. But it was almost too wide open. And what I found was when I finally found my prototype that I wanted to model, it helped me to focus and eliminated the thought gridlock sometimes. When anything is possible, it's almost like too much to consider. What I found was when I went proto, that I could say, well, you always have the fallback position of what's on the prototype. How did they do it? Can I make that fit my spot? Can I capture the essence of that? Rather than, you know, a guy like Mike Confalone, who approaches it from more of an artistic standpoint, in that he looks at a space and he thinks, how can that, you know, what can I do with that scene? It's a blank canvas for him completely. You know, he was over here today helping me out do a section of the Lackawanna River. And I had actually mentioned it on the podcast group that, you know, I was asking him some questions about potentially doing it a little differently from my usual Envirotex pour, because the thing is 8 feet long and I got to handle it in order to put it in place. In other words, we built this river scene off layout on an 8 foot long piece of plywood, and now it's going to be put onto the layout once that's finished. So, he started talking about it. He says, you know, I want to do some work on the Lehigh. I said, why don't you do that river? Come down to my house and do the river. So I worked hard this week to get the river scene prepped for him. And, geez, it was almost anticlimactic. He did the Mod Podge in like 10 minutes. And I looked at him like, really? You're going to do other stuff now? Yeah. And I had him coloring ties the rest of the day, and he did some ballasting for me. And I was happy to have it, because you know what? Every tie he did and every section of railroad that he ballasted is something I don't have to do. I've certainly got plenty of that to do. But it was fun working together. We work on each other's layouts all the time. But, you know, he had some, you know, we always discuss different areas on each other's layout. And he was talking about a couple of things that I was brainstorming with him today. And it was very clear he's approaching it from a purely artistic viewpoint that didn't take into consideration how much work had already gone into having it like it was, and B, why it was like that. So we often have some wrestling matches along those lines, but it's all in good fun. And I'm always happy to have the input, you know?
Right. I think that's important. I think you're the only guy to build a river off layout. I've seen guys build bridges and other things and then bring it in, but I've never heard of, we're going to build a river. That's
it's,
pretty good.
It's a new one on me, I'll tell you. And even though I'm enjoying the challenge of doing this particular spot, which I knew before I even built the addition was going to be a bear, but I thought, you know what, if I can pull this off, it's the only way. See, I approached the track design, and even to a certain extent the design of the addition, from the standpoint of, here's the traffic I would like to realistically represent on the layout. And in order to do it, I needed to do the interchange between TNH and Conrail. I needed to do the Taylor secondary from Pittston to Taylor. I needed to incorporate the Pocono Northeast short line, which interchanges and runs over sections of both railroads in addition to their own track. It took me a long time and a lot of conversations with people who were working on those railroads in the past, you know, guys like Mike Bednar and my buddy Tony V on the RNN and others, really lots of people down there that I got introduced to. Once I understood the traffic flow, I thought to myself, okay, now that's interesting. And if I can represent that on the model railroad, I'll never get bored because there's a lot of options in terms of how you run things. Certain things are going to run all the time, you know, like the Conrail mainline freights, but there's so many different locals. We're not going to, I can envision maybe three different operating scenarios, you know what I mean? And if you figure you're not going to have an op session within less than, say, 6 weeks, well, by the time you get to the end of the third operating scenario and you get back to the first one, months will have passed, you know what I mean? So you'll never have that lather, rinse, repeat feeling if you don't want to.
Right. Do you feel, see, here's what I'd like, the changes that you've done, and I've done changes on my layout, but mine being proto freelance, I changed how it operates because of operation sessions and how things flow and I learn more. Did you change yours looking at the prototype saying, I want to run these trains, and to do that, I need to have this and this and this?
Well, I think it was a combination of both. So when I, you know, I, people say, how long have you been building your layout? And I say, well, if you look at it one way, I started building my layout more than 20 years ago. On the other hand, 99% of what you would see is either gone or changed. So the layout as it stands is somewhere between 6 and 7 years old at this point. I call it the, you know, the modern phase of it, where I figured out my prototype and had it based on actual knowledge instead of just, you know, because it's kind of more of a lone wolf, you know. When I started out the layout construction, it was basically just me and my buddy Dave, you know. And then as you meet people, you know, you go to train meets, you meet people, easy to make friends there because you have a lot of common interests with some people. And you start going to op sessions with people who know what they're doing, who've been around the block, who have solved some of these problems that you haven't even run into yet, and are doing it the way you'd want to do it. You know what I mean? So yeah, I learned a tremendous amount from even just like one guy operating at Confalones, and he's not the only guy. You know, Neil Schofield's one of those guys, and Jim Reddington's one of those guys, and, you know, Ken Karlowitz, you know, all these people who have nice layouts that you get to operate on. I learn tremendous amount from each new place that I visit. Sometimes it's just a place you visit once, you know. People are very, very accommodating and invite you to operate on their layout. I've been all over the place, really. But you get something from each one of those solo visits, but you get a completely different thing from repetitive operating sessions on a nice layout that is trying to do it right. Because usually you do a postmortem at the end of the op sessions anyway. You talk about what went well, what maybe didn't go so well, and no two op sessions are alike. Depends who the crew is. It depends what you're deciding, how you're deciding to run at that time. The traffic is different when you're running your car circulations prototypically. That's kind of what drives it. You know, sometimes, you know, you go up to Confalones and one of the yards that's not normally empty, like New Sharon, empty. You say, what happened? He says, just how the traffic was, you know, this time. And that might mean that some other place is plugged and needing help, you know. And I think that sounds to me very prototypical.
That does. I think it's important, like what you said, to have that hive mind. And you're surrounded, you know, with Mike and Neil Schofield and Bob Fallowfield and all the other fields. But
right,
you know, my little crew, I'm kind of benefiting because one of my hive guys is a clinical psychologist, so we kind of get the brain talking.
I like the concept of the hive mind. I've heard that. Yeah. And it really does. I think I've referred to it sometimes as the brain trust. You know what
the
I mean?
The brain trust, yeah.
Sometimes I bounce stuff off of these guys and we get nowhere, or the stuff I get back just doesn't work for me. And sometimes somebody will just say something, I'll just look at them and I'll just think, genius. I never would have thought of that. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah,
and it, I mean, ideally, it goes both directions, you know what I mean? But there's almost nothing that doesn't benefit from an intelligent conversation with like-minded individuals, you know what I mean? Yeah. I want a cabinet, you know what I mean? I don't want a bunch of yes men.
Right. And you want specialists in each area. And
well, like it's true.
You learn from operating. And one of the things I always tell everybody, even on the pro railroad, when we're teaching new guys, is you learn from everybody.
Absolutely.
You go to these layouts, but here's how you're going to learn what to do. But even more importantly, you're going to learn what not to do. If that makes sense.
Why reinvent the wheel? You know, why
make the way?
Exactly. And these guys are all peers, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I work on their layouts, they work on my layouts, and I don't worry about it at all. You know what I mean? We're compatible modelers. And that's a huge plus, I think.
It is. It is. And it's just nice to have everybody who can give you that. Not like you said postmortem. I always call it feedback. And I try and tell my operators and the crew, our little operating crew of three or four guys whose layouts we go to, is let me know the next day. Send me an email of what you liked and what you didn't like.
Yeah.
And I said, because
I want
it's too
that
hot.
Feedback.
It's just, to me, it's too hot in the moment. You know, you're like, okay, I survived the session hosting. Everybody's going. And somebody's like, well, that stinks. I'm like, no, not now. You know, give me tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. I'll go fix that. I'll solder that.
I'm very familiar with that feeling, but I will say that the more sessions you host, the less that mostly goes away. You find out, one of the things we found out was, what's the right number of people, you know? And believe it or not, no matter how big the layout is, five or six guys is about right, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because when you have more than that, you have to resort to two-man crews, and you're more cognizant of keeping people busy. And when they're not busy, they're just gumming up the works. You know what I mean? It's like you want to keep people busy, but not have it be frantic. You know what I mean? So
plus the ergonomics of moving the people around your layout.
That's right. If you're not planning your aisles properly, you're not gonna. And that's another thing that you benefit from visiting other layouts. You know, you learn where you can get away with a pinch point and where you can't, and how long it should be before it becomes a problem, and that kind of thing. So, absolutely on that. So I think we got a little off track here, but like any good conversation, I wanted to know a little bit about how you came up with your concept, and maybe you could describe what it is, and then, you know, what led you to that.
What I wanted to do was iron ore hauling. That's, you know, Minnesota, Upper Michigan, Wisconsin. It's just native. These iron ore railroads, you know, the Mesabi, the Great Northern.
See, I assumed that's what you were doing on the real railroad, but you weren't, were you?
No, not where I am. We hauled no iron ore.
Interesting.
But as you know, as a kid growing up, we'd vacation up there. You know, our family, we'd go up to the Boundary Waters, and we'd see the road. And I went to college in Duluth, you know, and had all the iron ore railroads there were running, chasing them and rail fanning them. And how I got to my concept was my smaller space. And railroads like the Mesabi, Duluth Mesabi and Orange, and the Great Northern were too big.
Sure.
You know, I couldn't do them justice. And the smaller railroads that I liked, Erie Mining Company and Reserve Mining Company, hauled taconite or taconite rock,
which is too boring. Right.
So I invented this company that... How these taconite companies came about in the mid-50s when the natural ore was running out, politicians had to find a way to keep jobs and keep everybody working all this money. So they changed the tax structure in our state so it was profitable to make taconite, to make these iron ore pellets and haul steel and mine and do it that way. And because of that, they were able to form two brand new railroads. One was Erie Mining, and one was Reserve Mining, which were totally dedicated lines of just hauling their taconite and pellets on the rocks from the mine to the dock and back.
And Erie was all those quartets of F units, right?
Yep. The road trains were F units and Jeeps, and in the mines they had Baldwins and RS-11s and
C-420s.
And really neat, and Reserve really had some cool engines too, even like the only SD-28s. They had four of the six, and...
Wow, I don't think I've even seen a picture of one of those.
Yeah, I'm building two of them. You'll get to see them. So,
what are you building it out of? An SD-35?
SD-35.
Okay. So it's got like a Jeep 38 set of fans, two fans?
It's got two separated fans. It's a non-turbocharged SD-35.
Okay. Paper air filter?
No. It's got some other kind of filter on there, but it's got like the two stacks.
Okay.
and the little dynamic brakes. And then, and even it's kind of interesting on one of them as a modeler where like the little bulge on the fireman's side on the long hood is. See, they didn't have the turbo. They didn't need that. So they actually put a cabinet in there. I can send you a picture, I posted of half of one of these, and they put it, they said, well, we got this space, let's put tools in there.
I'd love to see that. Yeah. You know, that's the kind of thing, if you can just throw it up on the crew call group. Yeah. I think, you know, we're talking about it, people would love to see it
with an arrow pointed on there. So I wanted a haul ore because they have to switch it.
Right.
So I said, okay, in the 50s, the way Northern Range, Northern Minnesota had the Vermilion Iron Range, and the middle was the Mesabi, and then in the middle of the state was the Cuyuna Range. So there's three big piles of iron ore buried.
Yep.
And so with the taconite, the border ones up in the, along the border of Canada got left out. They had underground mines. Those were the oldest ones. So they had underground mines. And I'm putting on it that they said, give us modern mining techniques, give us modern drilling, modern this, and we'll make the ore more valuable, because the iron ore, and this is the truth, the iron ore up in the Vermilion Range is such a high content of iron, and it requires so little processing, if any. You can actually take two chunks of it out of the ground and weld them together.
Wow.
I know.
So what is taconite? Like a purified low-grade ore, basically?
Correct, yeah. So that it's like if you had a rock and it had maybe 5% iron in it, they would crush this all down. And then they'd crush it into a dust, and they'd put it in a slurry. And then in the slurry, they'd have magnets.
Ah, yank it out.
Separate the rocks out. So then they'd have all this iron, and then they'd add bentonite clay to it.
To bind it,
and then they'd roll it in these ovens, and they'd bake these pellets.
I gotcha.
And they can make them whatever percent of iron that the mills want.
I see. So you can tell them, you can custom order it, basically.
Right. And the new super pellets, they're adding in the limestone, the flux. Oh. And so, that's just kind of keeping them relevant. It's like you can have all of this in one. And plus, it's easier handling. It's easier unloading. It's, they don't have to blend it. The thing with ore is, each car was sampled. Somebody went around and took five scoops of ore out of each car, did an analysis, sent it down to the main yard. And then they had to blend, the ship came in from Bethlehem Steel and they wanted 85% iron. So you'd have to blend cars that had 30, cars that had 90, cars that, on these docks, in the docks and in the cars, it was a huge process.
So this thing that you built, and we're going to get to that, is that where the blending was done?
Correct. On the ore docks.
I didn't know that.
And they'd have to make the shoves. And that's why I used, I'm sure I'll post a picture up, the little pins in my ore loads to designate the iron ore content.
Okay. Yep.
And I don't make my operators come up with it. I just tell them, okay, this needs 5 yellows, 5 greens. This needs all black. This needs all orange.
I saw those pins on some pictures you posted prior to, and I just thought, I wonder what that means.
Yeah. And so that's the switching. And
yes.
So it's not boring taconite that when it gets down to the yard, it has to be weighed. I've got a little scale. And then you sort them based on the dock shoves, because they shove the cars out onto the ore dock and they have to spot them in specific pockets for each boat.
So does the ore on the prototype get mixed inside of that chamber somehow? Is there a screw auger of some kind? Or
no, it's like a big
vat.
So on the prototype, it would probably take the pockets in the dock. They're called pockets, so it's a big bin.
Okay.
And you can dump like two ore cars, so it holds like two ore cars worth.
Okay.
And then they'll dump like three more per bin. So everything is mixed in the boat.
Oh.
But what they would do at the dock, because some of the ore was slippery, some was sticky, some was rocks, they wanted the ore that would slide better on the bottom. If you're on the second floor of your house and you're going to slide stuff down and let's put this, that'll go easier. We'll put that on top of that. So they used to do that too.
Huh?
Yeah. It was just an amazing, the more I dig into it, the wilder it gets how they blended this.
So how much of your layout is this dock?
Just along one wall.
Okay, it's one wall's worth.
Yep.
And then like the rest of the layout is you moving ore to the dock, basically?
Correct, yeah, from the dock has 36 pockets.
Wow, how long is it?
Let's say about 6 feet.
Okay.
And it's one of the smaller ones. You know, I said it's a small, it's compressed layouts.
But it looks, you know, I've seen some pictures. It looks very highly detailed.
Yeah, the more I'm going with it, that, you know, that's my project now. Adding your wonderful etched brass railings makes it stand out. I just put people on it today. I should send a picture.
So maybe, and if I'm getting ahead of your description, just pause me, but is it styrene?
It's a plastic Walters kit. Walters made it, and then I adapted to make better detail parts, control okay. stand.
So in other words, it's not scratch built, it's kit bashed, no, basically.
Correct, yeah.
And it must be more than one Walters kit to make it, right?
Right, yep. It's two, I think it's two or three.
Yeah.
And
the parts that you're making or acquiring to make it better, have you had some of these built?
No, I did it all myself. I used styrene.
Okay.
And you know, it's repetitive. So you got to have 36 yokes, 36 number boards. 36. So I have my poor man's laser, my Cricut cutter.
Oh, yes.
And I designed it and then shoved the styrene in there and then it cuts it all out. And
now, this is going to get us off on a tangent, but
yep.
I think Craig Biesgeier uses a Cricut cutter too. And I meant to ask him more questions about this. I can understand how it can cut. What software-wise do you have to do to get it to cut what you want?
It comes with its own software called Design Space.
Okay, it's like a little lightweight CAD program?
Correct. And then the plus is you can import your design. So if you made something on SketchUp or CAD or something and then saved it in a certain type of file, like I'm the worst at computers, but an SVG file.
Yep.
You can bring that in.
But it won't read a printing. I mean, you can't scan something and have it cut it.
No. But here's what you can do. I'm gonna mess you up now. So it can scan and cut. We call it print and cut. So let's say you had a depot or you had a sign or something. You could bring in a picture of that sign. And then it'll send that picture to a printer. And the print thing that comes out of your laser printer has marks on it that it can read.
Really?
And so then you put that through the machine, and it'll cut that out. No matter how many jagged, how many this, it'll cut that out exactly on paper. And then you can put styrene in there, and it'll cut out the backing. I've done wonderful billboards for my friends for like some of these odd beer signs and things like that. I made my friend a big Ford sign for on top of his auto plant.
And will it work with both wood and styrene depending upon the thickness?
Yes, depending upon the blade you put in there. A lot of people are getting to the wood now. So
how thick of a styrene can you cut with it?
I've gone up to like 040. It won't cut through.
Really?
It won't cut through, but like, you know, styrene, you etch it and then you just snap it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it'll come out and then I just snap it right off.
So 020 or 030, it would cut it probably?
Yeah. And it's real easy to pop out, you know.
Because you know what I'm thinking, you know, anytime you build a structure, one of the things you hate to do is cut out doors and windows, right?
Oh,
I mean,
God, yeah.
I'm having Jimmy Simmons laser cut the Ransom brick building because I just couldn't bear the thought of, it's just drudgery cutting. I don't know how many openings are in that building, but it's all windows, right? You know, it's not like I'm kit bashing it out of a Walther's kit. I would have to start with brick sheet. You know what I mean? And then that's when Scott and I started talking about, well, gee, you know, we could draw this up and I could laser it for you. But this is like the building that, I don't know, year three are we in maybe? It's at least year two, you know, and I still don't have a wall, but I think we're getting closer. I noticed Jimmy is posting some of his prototypes on the podcast group for sale. If anybody has never seen his buildings in person, boy, they are exquisite. So I hope they all go to nice homes because they certainly deserve it. And I'm really looking forward to receiving this Ransom paper mill because it's, I think once it comes in, I'm going to be highly motivated to jump right on that building, because that's sort of the limiting factor in getting a maybe a eight or more foot long section of the layout presentable, you know. So I think that's probably going to be a summer project for me.
Yeah, and that's what the, Cricut can do. You can measure up Tichy windows or Grantline and draw, you know, draw a wall, a rectangle there, and then draw a little the exact size holes for these windows and where you want the door, and it'll carve all that out, and then you just pop them out and put your windows in.
And it's not a very expensive device, is it?
No, no, they're about, I'd say around 200.
Exactly, right. It's not like a milling machine, you know, or a 3D printer or something like that.
Right. And they're coming down, and you can do it by air. I mean, you could design on your iPad or other thing and send it to it.
Huh.
And all kinds of things like that. Yeah, people are doing creative stuff with it. That's a whole nother podcast.
Exactly. Well, if I get one, it's going to be a series of podcasts.
Yeah.
I'll have to get everybody on that I know that has one, and they can teach me how to use it.
Yes. Yeah. There's some really great blogs on Model Railroad Hobbyists about the uses of a Cricut, the print and cut.
Jeez. So how far along is your ore dock? Is it substantially complete at this point?
I would say it's 60%. I have to work on the water line is next, putting in the retaining wall. And then I want to build the dock office. And then the steps down to the two walkways, you know, cause there's, they have what they call it the poker deck. And there's like a deck at the middle of the dock. And if things got stuck on the chutes down to the ore boat, the guys would go down there with poles and, you know, help it move along.
Real low tech.
Yeah, low tech. Yeah, everything about this is low tech. And then
interesting. And that's the poker deck. So now you said you had gotten from me some of my two pipe railings. And I guess that runs all along the top edge of the dock. Is that how that works?
That is correct. It's the perfect height, and it's a, you know, it's so delicate. It looks just like the real thing. I'm looking at it now, and it's, and people are asking, where'd you get that? I'm telling them, you and Mike's going to get that.
Right here. So, I had that. In fact, I had Brian Bannett draw those up for me.
Oh, really?
I used his, he has drawn up a number of etched metal parts. And in fact, the GE steps for the locomotives that I sell were originally his, and he had drawn those up for various locomotives and produced and used them for himself, and basically was not interested in being a manufacturer. So, you know, we talked about it, and to make a long story short, I'm using his etcher and produce the parts. And geez, I've sold a lot of those steps to people. You know, there's nothing else. If you want EMDs, you know, you get the Canon stuff. But for GEs, there's no. I don't know of anything else that's available. And I'm using the same UK etcher to do the railings. And he was nice enough to draw them up for me.
Yeah, make some Elko steps for you. But hey, you know, the thing with these railings, if you ever change them, send along a little jig that someone can put down and mark where the holes go. that was the only tough part about these. I mean, they clipped out. They're wonderful. They accepted pain. I was like, oh, I gotta figure out how to mark these holes.
And I'm gonna tell you something that is gonna make you think. Now he tells me.
I use
a set of dividers to do it. I just set it to the width of the two things, and then I use the dividers to, you know, mark the first hole, swing it over. Poke, mark the second hole, swing it over, etc. Right on the line that you've drawn. So nice. It makes it very easy to reliably get the holes located where you want.
I suppose you could do that like if you're going around a circular one, like an elevator, you know, some at the top of a round.
You can do it really on any kind of any kind of a line, you know. You just mark the first one, keep one point of the divider in that spot, and then just swing it around to your very next location and just make a little, you know, a little drag, a little mark on it where it crosses the line. That's where you drill your hole.
Oh, nice. Okay. That was worth the price of admission.
ask me why I had to develop that.
Yeah.
My first thought, once I went to install my first one, which was on the big Grainzilla mill that I built, that now is earning its keep on Matt Herman's layout. So, you know, I was sorry to see that go, because boy, did I put some man hours into that thing. But again, I wanted it to go to a good home, you know. But I had the same problem, you know. I was installing it. You can picture the top of a grain elevator, you know, the sort of cement cap that sits on top of it. That there was this railing all around, and on the ends, it was actually a scalloped thing. So I'm thinking, how am I going to locate these holes? And then I came up with that method of doing it.
Nice.
No, it's all necessity.
Yeah, necessity. I think
advanced problem solving. The rest of your layout is how far along?
I'd say about 70%, because I did one of the things I was working for was on the National Model Railroad Association. I was going for my Master Model Railroader certificate. And so you had to do scenery, and what they want you to do is square footage. And so I didn't have to do my whole layout. I'm like, okay, they want this many square feet done. And so I got to concentrate on that.
Sure.
And so, and it also helps, I think I'm like you and everybody else, I've divvied my layout up into sections where now's the ore dock. I think I'm going to work on the little city section, and then I'll work on my diesel pit, and then I'll work on some, you know, I'm taking it chunks, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time?
Exactly. I was thinking that very phrase when you were saying that. And it is divide and conquer, although increasingly in modern times, I'm doing it a little bit differently. You know, I mean, of course, my situation is not very typical. Most people don't, you know, build a building, move a section of their layout out into it, and then have to connect in between the two. That's a very atypical thing to do. But I found, after my last op session, I had some goals for the winter, you know, and what I found was, as I got into it, you invariably run into things where you say, well, it would be nuts not to do this now while I'm doing this, or it would be crazy not to, you know, be working on the foam for that section while I'm in foam cutting mode, or it would be crazy to clean everything up from slinging dirt here only to have to dirt it all up, slinging dirt in this adjacent area. You know what I mean? It just kind of made sense to do similar things in roughly adjacent geographic areas, you know? So consequently, my gap between op sessions this time is a little bit more than I would have liked, maybe a month and a half more. But when the guys come back, they're going to go, whoa, because it will have gone from basically track and bench work to fascia and ground, and a lot of it's scenic, you know what I mean? Like borderline presentable. So that's a big step forward.
Yeah, that fascia really changes everything. That was a game changer, those photos. And
that actually exceeded my expectation for it. You know, I as I was doing, again, perfect example, I was going to do it in a section so I knew where to bring my foam up to. And, you know, my buddy Dave's retired, so he's kind of on tap, you know what I mean? So a lot of the two-man stuff that used to take forever, because I could only get them once a week, it's not the case anymore, you know what I mean? So when you're putting up 8-foot sections of this stuff around a curved end, you want some help doing that, you know? And the ability to just call him up and say, Dave, I need your help tomorrow to do X. He just comes over and we just knock it off. You know what I mean? So a lot of that has gone very fast, and it's such high impact that again, you think, well, I might as well just keep going right around that aisle and connect up to some existing. And then the fascia is done. And basically the fascia is done. I've got a couple of small strips to put here and there, but it's basically 98% complete, you know, and that makes a big difference.
And I think that's good to have, you know, your friend coming over to do that, because it's not something where you have to put your signature, you know, I really want to detail this mill, or I want to do this, you know. It's like, help me put up the fascia, help me hang the wires, help me put in the jacks for the DCC, you know, help me bulletproof my layout, and then I'll make it look like, you know, the Lehigh area.
No, absolutely. I mean, I would say last year around this time, we put up almost 850 square feet of bench work in about 2 months.
Wow.
That would have taken me forever doing it the old way, you know, but everything's different now. You know, there's star drive screws and impact drivers, and, you know, I've got a pretty good workshop now, and I don't have to go outside to go back and forth between it in the winter. everything is just conducive to just, you know, working seamlessly here. You know, everything's the way it ought to be, and it makes a huge difference.
And plus, everybody has the tools. So when they come over, bring your drills, bring your charger, bring your, you know. But yeah, I think that's good to have people help you with that portion of the layout. I'll ask for help with that. You know, I may hang my backdrops. But.
Well, you know, when it's time to put that stream bed in place, I'll be calling for some help. So you had asked me, I think, off show, what my era was. Remember that?
Correct, yeah.
Now, my era is 1984. It's changed some. When I was modeling the prototype as of today, I was a 90s modeler, and that was driven a lot by the fact that I was doing a lot of rail fanning during that time. So that was probably my most traveled decade, you know, the 90s, very, very late 80s, and then right into the late 90s. And, you know, Conrail ended in 1998, and I thought, huh, that's never happened before. Yeah. To me, to something I'm modeling, and then I thought, I'm a period modeler. Who knew? And at that time, I was still freelance, right? So it was only when I stumbled upon my prototype, just kind of bouncing around in Pennsylvania, that I started to think, okay. And then you learn more about your prototype, and a lot of it was driven by the big mill, the big Procter & Gamble mill at Mehoopany, because in 19, I think it was 88 or 89, that's when they stopped shipping by rail. If you went to that place now, there used to be three yards there. And now there's basically one. On my layout, there are two. There were four yards there. There was East and West Yard, there was Chemical Yard, and there was this Middle Yard, which was, I think, there just to facilitate getting stuff in and out of the buildings properly. Now they're basically down to you know, one just West Yard, because it's just raw materials in boxcars. That's really all that comes into the place now. But in 1984, they were moving 100 cars a day out of that facility, if you can believe that.
Wow. Okay.
And that facility was on the Lehigh Valley main line. And as such, the valley had no trouble keeping them supplied with cars. When Conrail took over, the Lehigh line in that area became a much greatly reduced line in terms of its usage, to the point where in my area, there were only a couple of trains each way a day going through there. So they were, as they got into the late 80s, they were really chronically starved for cars. They couldn't ship goods out. And I guess Conrail pissed them off to the point where at the end they just said, Conrail started slapping surcharges on the cars too. So that basically drove them to truck. And if you go there today, there are hundreds and hundreds of trailers on site in a giant lot just uphill from the plant, so that they always have, transportation for the stuff going out of there. It's amazing, really.
So 84, you're limited, which is, you know, it's not limited, but you can focus. You don't have SD60s, dash eights, or double stacks.
That's correct.
So you can just.
So modern loco for me is an SD50.
Would be a 50 or like a Jeep 40-2 or something. Okay.
Yeah. Although at that point, 40-2s were primarily in intermodal service. Mm-hmm. So what you saw on my line a lot, I've seen a lot of pictures, and you saw a lot of, like the road freights would have, there were still SD45s at that time, and SD40s before they were converted to SD40-2s. And SD40-2s, but also a lot of four-axle power. You'd see scads of Jeep 38s and U23s and B23-7s, and a lot of NCAB switchers still in use. Pittston Yard had many locals running out of that yard, going all over the place, and that's what we do here too. So it's a way to get a much greater variety of motor power. and used cabooses.
Yeah, I was going to say it was 84, the end of the cabooses, because that's been it. That's been a learning lesson for me is modeling the 60s, late 60s, is, you know, cabooses are on everything, how to handle them.
Right.
And I've had to change my designs by.
They're always in the way.
They're always in the way. I was like, now I know I railroads got rid of these, you know.
Right.
Let alone, you know, on the prototype, we have in the Mississippi River bottoms, we do a lot of manned pushers, unbelievable, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Being on the back of a train is like, okay, now I know why they got rid of a cabooses.
Oh, yeah. No, I've spoken to, you know, conductors who have gone, you know, several miles hanging onto the grab iron of a covered hopper in the middle of the winter. Yeah. And they do not describe it as fun.
No, it's not a highlight.
So, no. I mean, in many ways, I had actually backdated to 85 because from a traffic standpoint, it gave me the same advantages. But then when I started getting a little more info, I realized that actually 84, that was a year where there were some locomotive retirements and I could still get away with an SD35 in 84.
Very good.
Without stretching it too much. And, you know, there were a lot of Jeeps, you know, still in use at that time. So the more I looked into it, the more it just became a very attractive, you know, period of time. You probably saw that I was selling off some freight cars because I still had plenty of 90s era cars on the layout that I needed to get rid of. And I always joke, you know, Chris Butts, who's a very, very knowledgeable freight car guy. I mean, very knowledgeable. Every time he comes over, he always just kind of points at a car and raises an eyebrow like, nope.
Yeah, get that T-box out of here and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Exactly. You know, so even to the point of paint schemes, you know, like he'll say, you know, had some solid coiled reefers that were redone in the SGLR scheme, you know, and says, nope, that's early 90s. Okay. Scrape it off, you know, stuff like that. So,
See, I ran into the opposite problem because my railroad didn't exist prior to 1955, which a lot of people can't, you know, they're like, you have Elcos, get some RS3s and that. I was like, no, they were not in the Elco catalog.
So what is the motive power that you're handling now? What are you running there?
Anything from an RS11 is what they would have dieselized with to newer. And what I run now.
So 251s onwards, basically.
Correct. Okay. Yep. Because there were no, that was in the catalog. So RS32s, RS27s, RS36s. And then as I go forward into building the Century series, I'll have a couple of the, you know, because I like those. That's what I really like are the Centuries. But
yeah, you're going to find that the Atlas C420 is one sweet locomotive. Boy,
oh, yeah.
So beautiful. I think it's one of their best locomotives that they ever did. It just runs like a Swiss watch. They got the detailing right.
Yep.
It's you can you know, for layout operations, you can, it's like the prototype one, you know, you can just run it till it drops and it will never drop.
Yeah, that's, and I've got two of those in the shop because they're just gorgeous. And yeah, I think, but my road, like, get away with four axle. There's a lot of ore mining roads with four axle, but Elcos could lug, you know.
That's right.
Loaded ore trains go 30, you know, so it's, I'm not the New York Central or Conrail piggyback. So,
the dimensions of your layout room are roughly what?
The whole room's probably 20 by 12, and my layout's probably 16 by 12. So it's double deck.
Yeah. Oh, it's double deck. Okay.
Yeah.
Are both decks scenic?
Yes.
Okay. So you've got plenty of layout there.
Right. And I don't have a helix. I kind of have a Nolix, but the helix is open. It's all scenery. It's the hill.
The whole layout is a helix.
Well, half of it is a helix, you know, where the mines and the upper yard, that's level, and the dock and the lower yard is level. And then the climb up through the woods and everything.
I did exactly the same thing here, believe it or not. I have a certain leg of it as hidden trackage, but basically you end up going around the original basement twice without even realizing it. And it's not a double deck layout. It's just got different levels that sort of work together. It's the only way I can describe it, you know. But a helix takes up an enormous amount of room and such valuable real estate. I had a hard time fitting that into the old basement, and I'm kind of glad I did it this way. I get some realistic grades that I don't go over 2%, I shouldn't say that. The Taylor secondary is more than that, but I think it is on the prototype as well. You know, here's a secondary line that they would often use helpers that were on the mountain cutoff to get this local up the hill, believe it or not.
Right. And, you know, friends don't let friends build helixes. So I avoided that. So I'm like, no, if I'm going to have it, like, even the bottom is like a shadow box scene of a defect detector and things you put in there. I'm like, no, I don't want to hide. I'm
thinking of the year I went over and helped Neil Schofield build his.
Yeah, there you go.
I'd never built one, and it was very interesting. I'm glad I got to do it. But it confuses me to this day. He's got different entrances and exits from it. And when I operate on his layout, I think I need to operate more often there to really get a feel for what's going where.
It's a genius invention, but I just didn't want one. I didn't have the space. And I'm like, no.
I had actually in one iteration drawn up a helix big enough that I was going to locate the Dartmouth Locomotive Works install shop inside of it. And I thought, you know, this will be cool. Everything will be within arm's reach, and I can have this big arc-shaped install desk. And I had it drawn up, and I think from that standpoint, it actually would have worked. I had it in such a way that I could have just sat in my swivel chair and ducked a little bit and rolled right under the bottom and been inside of it, you know. But I think I like the current shop, which actually has a window, and I can look out into the woods, and it's like you don't feel so much like you're cooped up in the basement when you're just there working on locos, you know.
But that's an ingenious use of space, though. I mean, that should be like a contest in one of the magazines. What can you do inside a helix, you know, to make it a productive area?
Well, some people put like a dispatcher's office inside of the helix. You know, it's good use for it. And actually, I think I solved the inside the helix problem. What I never solved was the outside the helix problem. You know, it took up just a big chunk of basement. And the more I looked at that spot, I probably spent 2 months just, you know, I had it kind of like mocked up on the ground. You know, you had to look at it and go, that's an awful lot of real estate. And just to get from one level to another, there's got to be another way. And I thought about it and 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 thought about it. And at the time, I was doing a lot of biking during the summer, and I had one bike ride where I was biking out in the country, but I was just thinking about this problem. And I was about as far away as I was going to be that day. And all of a sudden, I kind of like clicked on it, and I thought, I've got it. And then I couldn't wait to get back and look at it to make sure I wasn't like, for, you know, not thinking about something that would prevent me from doing it. And when I got back on my bike, still in my stupid bike gear, I went downstairs and I'm looking at it. And then I called up Confalone and I said, you're not going to believe this, but here's what I'm proposing to do. And to his credit, he listened to the whole thing without saying anything. And then there was a pause, and he said, it's a bold move, but I think you should do it. And the rest is history.
Nice. Yeah, because didn't you just write about that, like your two levels and just the scene divider? You didn't like it. Isn't that it? You know,
Yeah, but that was a while ago. Okay. Yeah. That was a few years ago, you know.
Oh, I mean, that portion.
Yeah, okay. That was one of the earlier layout kabooms.
It all blends together, I think.
Maybe. Oh, I know. It's all a blur, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, you got away from the helix, so that's the best part.
Exactly. And I've got another column coming up with a deadline, I think in March. And I'm trying to have this the rest of this DuPont and Avoca scene ready for it, because the last article was about the road bridge there. And that's like one – it's a very visible sort of key aspect of the whole scene, but it's like one-tenth of the whole thing there, you know what I mean? So I'm trying not to – have to do the article without the scene being finished. I'd like to get it all to that presentable stage. And I think in a couple of weeks I can be there.
I think it's important to do that, to have signature scenes.
You got to do it. And I think on a good layout, especially a big layout, you've got room for, you know, several of them, you know, and it's okay for things in between to be less distinct, because that's kind of what the real world is like. You know, you go through some scenery sometimes, but not a lot going on, but that also lends the feeling of you're going somewhere, and then you get to the next scene. You know, if your whole layout was signature scenes, it would look like John Allen's, you know what, right? I mean, yeah. Which he was a heck of a modeler in his time and very influential. you look back on some of those concepts now and you think, wow, you know, we've come a long way really, you know, since then. But he was one of the first, you know, big picture kind of modelers, you know, that I was reading about as a kid in Model Railroader.
Right. Right. And you don't want everything to be a trope, you know, to go from this to the next thing to the, you know, here's the circus, here's the coal mine and the gazebo. You know, I like that you have a signature. Okay, this is the triple crossing, and then you're going to go through the countryside and then you're going to come out. Okay, here's the mill, you know.
And exactly.
That's what I tried, like go from the Lake Superior to the North Woods of almost Canada.
And right. And the way I've got the thing designed now, if you were to start in the Allentown staging yard, and then you didn't stop, you just went at a realistic like 40 mile an hour speed over the whole layout with your train, it would take you over 20 minutes to get to Sayre staging on the other end. You know what I mean? So, and you never go over the whole railroad without stopping at least Mahoopany and Pittston. You know what I mean? So there are guys that start out at, you know, 10:30 in the morning with a train, and, you know, they don't get done until after lunch sometimes.
Sure.
You know, so sure. They feel like they're going someplace and they're doing something, which is what I want it to do. What I want it to be.
So it's the former Lehigh Valley then, Allentown to Sayre?
Correct. Much? Correct.
Okay. What is the division called? Is it something you made up or does it?
No, it's the Lehigh line. And depending upon what time frame you're talking about, it was in different divisions. Ah. So when you go from, like, between Towanda and Sayre is the boundary between the Philadelphia division and the Albany division in 1984.
Okay.
But if you were to look at a different time period, the divisions would be different. And you got to really watch it when you're doing your research, you know what I mean? Because,
right.
You know, a lot of the ZTS maps that I'm using are from like either the late 80s or the early 90s, you know what I mean? So I have to also fall back on first-person accounts and pictures and things like that to sort of extrapolate what would have been like earlier, right?
Is that a real crew district then, if it goes over two divisions, Allentown to Sayre, or was that...
Well, I think the way they did it, you know, we run one local south out of Sayre that does the Towanda and Wyalusing areas, and that was an Albany division crew, and they did cross boundaries there, right, to get into Towanda and Wyalusing, but it was an Albany division crew and had nothing to do with the other division, right? The other locals came out of Pittston Yard and went north and south and other compass points.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's what I was, you know.
But you have to watch your symbols, right? So one is a WP symbol, way Philadelphia, and the other one is a WA, way Albany.
And so were they out and back then, or were they?
Oh yeah. All these locals were out and back.
Very good.
It's only the road freights that were, you know, point to point basically.
That would get there.
So when we run a road freight, for example, CGAL, that's Corning, New York to Allentown. That's one train. And that's what it does in that session. It comes out of North staging like Sayre and runs over the whole layout and ends up in Allentown staging. We also run the reverse ALCG. It's just the other side of that train, but it's not the same train.
Right, right. And those are kind of, I call those scenery trains, you know, but the locals have to dodge them and the dispatchers.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's our version of the California Zephyr, but it's.
Yeah, and we had to learn how to. Yeah, we had to learn. Well, they all, both of those trains, all of the road trains work in Mahoopany and they work in Pittston.
Oh, so they do a block set out or something.
Correct. Okay. Correct. So you have to be thinking about that when you're making up your train in staging. And sometimes we'll just run like a ballast train or something. There's a through train that goes all the way through. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah.
But there wasn't a lot of that kind of thing. I there was an occasional detour. I mean, I've seen DNH engines on a, I guess a, that'd be a southbound in Pittston Yard that for whatever reason detoured over the Lehigh line from Buffalo instead of going over their own trackage to head down to Philly. You know what I mean? So right. There were isolated instances of that, but you want to do that every once in a blue moon, basically.
Right. Just as a special thing. I get that. So, okay.
So you've got a blog at Model Railroad Hobbyist. How long have you been doing that?
I looked, it started in 2011 was the first post I did.
Wow. I didn't realize you'd been doing it all that long.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm like the world's worst author for them. You know, I spend almost no time on the site. I don't listen to other people's podcasts. I don't even listen to my own, actually.
Yeah.
But because I'm too busy modeling and installing decoders. You know what I mean? So, I think there's a wealth of information out there in these various blogs there. So how does one view your blog? Do you just go to the Model Railroad Hobbyist website and go to the blog section?
Yeah, I would say on the search bar, I'm under Split Rock 323, because you always had a number.
Okay.
And that was my wedding anniversary.
All right.
It's kind of a quick way to remember my anniversary so the wife doesn't get after me. So
that's a good thing to remember.
Then MH and then Split Rock Mining Company layout on Facebook and YouTube.
Okay.
So.
And I'm probably on your Facebook group. I think I must be.
Yes.
But I would love to have you post some of your photos, especially the stuff we talked about on Crew Call. I think the listeners would find that fascinating.
Sure. I can do that. I think it's always fun. I like looking at what other guys post on there, especially Ken. Ken was
an
opener with that. His D&H stuff is amazing.
His layout is just talk about a layout that's just a beautiful layout. You know what I mean? He approaches everything about his layout modeling from the standpoint of a photographer. He's got the photographer's eye. The guy's like a killer photographer. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like I take pictures. He's a photographer. You know, there is a difference. Compositionally, light. I mean, he just understands light to the nth degree, the way that a real pro photographer does. So he has taken great pains to sort of light his layout in a way that each scene would be optimally photographed, which is a little unusual for a model railroad, almost like a series of dioramas, but it's contiguous. So when I go to his place, I always like to take photos of layouts that I visit. Problem at his house is you never not find a place that's photogenic. Every time you move 6 inches, it's like another viewpoint. You, I got to take a picture of that. You know what I mean? It's unusual in that regard. So, that's really what floats his boat. That and, of course, rail fanning. He's going to be out seeing the detours on the VTR tomorrow because of the Hoosick Tunnel being closed. So he's going to be out there bright and early tomorrow. So you'll probably be seeing some pictures that he'll be posting from tomorrow's efforts this weekend.
Oh, very nice. Hope he's got sunshine and stuff.
No, I haven't looked at the weather. It's always sunny in summer in Pennsylvania down in my basement here, right?
It's always 70. That's mine. It's always summer. It's always a warm summer evening in northern Minnesota.
Thomas, it was great talking with you. Appreciate you taking the time and sharing your efforts with us. And something tells me we'll be doing this again.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you for having me. This is fun.
All right. Take care.
Yep. Thanks, Mike.